Right, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the first meeting of the International Humanitarian Law Project for the new academic year. As most of you will, I hope, know by now, the project, although under the umbrella of the Law Department, is in fact interdisciplinary in its approach. Our aim is to study the role of law in relation to the conduct of armed conflict in its various different facets. Now, one of the problems with lawyers talking about the role of law in international hostilities is that we tend to know a bit about law. We talk a great deal about law, but hardly any of us know anything about the actual practice of fighting a war. We were therefore very pleased that Rupert Smith accepted our invitation to come and give the introductory lecture for this year. It would be difficult to think of anyone more qualified to speak on this subject than he is. Commissioned into the Parachute Regiment in 1964, he rose to the rank of four-star general, as the Americans would say, in the British Armed Forces, the highest rank we now have since the colourful, if perhaps somewhat redundant, rank of Field Marshal was abolished a few years ago. As a general, he commanded in three major conflicts. He commanded the British Division in the Gulf War in 1991, the British Armoured Division, the Desert Rats. He then went on to command UNPROFOR, the UN Protection Force in Bosnia, in 1995, where he and the troops under his command played an essential role in bringing that terrible conflict to an end. He commanded British forces in Northern Ireland in the end of the counterinsurgency period there. And then in his final job in the armed forces before he left the army at the end of 2001, he was the Deputy Supreme Allied Commander Europe, the highest ranking non-American officer in the NATO structure within Europe, and as such was deeply involved in the Kosovo conflict in 1999. Since leaving the army, he's written a book, The Utility of Force, The Art of War in the Modern World, published in Penguin, in paperback as well as hardback at a very reasonable price, though not, I regret to say, available for sale outside the lecture theatre tonight. In that book, he challenges many of the conceptions that not only we as lawyers and as civilians have had, but also his military colleagues have had about the nature of armed conflict, and suggests that we've moved into a quite different era in terms of the fighting of war from anything that existed for most of the 20th century. I'm delighted to welcome General Sir Rupert Smith to give our introductory lecture for this year.
He nearly walked off with my notes. Well, thank you very much indeed. I will talk for about 40 minutes and cover the essence of what I've written in this book, The Utility of Force. There isn't time to set the argument out completely, and so it'll be a series of assertions, but I'm happy in the time available in questions to enlarge on my assertions if you wish to. And I will try, particularly towards the end, to indicate where I think the changes I'm going to describe have a particular impact on the understanding of the law, its interpretation, its usefulness, and so forth. Now, it is my contention, argued in the book, that the nature of our operations today and in the future are fundamentally of a different nature to those of the past, and in particular for which our institutions have developed to conduct successfully. I call this form or model of war, the new form, war amongst the people, in contrast to the previous form, which I call industrial war. The essential difference is that military force is no longer used to decide the matter, but it is used to create a condition in which the strategic result is achieved, the strategic object being to alter the opponent's intentions rather than to destroy him. As a result, we do not move in a linear process of peace, crisis, war, resolution, peace, which is how we have tended to think of this matter in our history books and so forth. And that is how our institutions are structured governmental institutions and so forth to understand and to function in these circumstances. We do not move in that nice linear process. We are now in a world of continual confrontations and conflicts in which the military acts in the conflict support the achievement of the desired outcome to the confrontation. And the achievement of that desired outcome in the confrontation is achieved by means other than the military. Now, that's the essence of it, and I'll take you through it now. When I talk of institutions, I'm referring to the institutions of governance, whether they be in Whitehall, the District of Columbia, or any other capital, whether they be parliamentary or administrative, and whether they are national or intergovernmental. I refer to the executive institutions, the armed forces, the diplomatic, the intelligence services, the developmental services, and the multinational organizations such as NATO and so forth that we form from them. And I refer to the institutional relationships, the processes and authorities that link them all into a whole, and the international law would fall into that heading. Now, these institutions are, in the main, unsuited to our current circumstances. All of them need to change or be understood in a different way. We need to change the way we think about this matter and work in a different way. And to try and give you a metaphor for the magnitude of the change, I ask you to think of the world of art. Nearly 200 years ago, we had the realists. And then there appeared on the scene the impressionists. And the impressionists were trained as realists. They had the same paintbrushes. They had the same canvases. They had the same palettes. And they looked at the same view. But they had a completely different understanding of the outcome they were trying to achieve when they wielded their paintbrushes. And they produced a change in understanding and interpretation of art that took a long time for the world of art to understand and appreciate. And what I'm saying in the book and now is that we have shifted in our understanding of war from the realists to the impressionists. And as I go on to explain modern war, you'll see why I think the art of war now is an act of impressionism and not realism in that artistic sense. For sure enough, it's realistic enough if you're caught up in it. Now, I've also said that we are now in a world of confrontations and conflicts, and I'll try and explain what I mean by these words. They are not synonyms. They are frequently used as synonyms, particularly in the press and in general commentary. They are not synonyms. A confrontation occurs when two or more bodies in broadly the same circumstances are pursuing different outcomes. Political affairs of all stripes, national and international, are about resolving confrontations. And much of the law is the same. When the parties are resolved to work together or to abide by some rules or law, we have what I call collaborative confrontations. Indeed, as I've said, much of the law and the practice of it can be understood as a means of resolving, by a collaborative process, a confrontation. But when one or both sides cannot get their way and will not accept an alternative outcome, they sometimes seek to use military force to get what they want. They turn to conflict. Now, with industrial war, the previous paradigm, we sought to resolve the matter by conflict, War was intended to be strategically decisive. And we developed all sorts of laws, many customary, which were intended to control the way we fought our wars. However, in adopting conflict as the course of action, the side that is weak, if it is wise, does not play to the opponent's strengths, but rather follows the path of the guerrilla or the terrorist and avoids set battles, except on their own terms, and the operationally or strategically decisive engagement, so as not to present the opponent with the opportunity to strike the mortal blows and achieve their objective directly by force of arms. The wise, weak side adopts the generic strategy composed of the propaganda of the deed, the strategy of provocation, and the erosion of the will, so as to advance their position in the overall confrontation. Or else they seek to replicate the opponent's strength, and like North Korea and others, develop nuclear weapons while following the same generic strategy. Now, there's very little time to explain the generic strategy, but I'll try and do it as quickly as I can, and for those who want to me to expand upon it, I will do so at question time. How many of you have brought up or been associated with very young children? Not breeding much, are we? Think back to your own childhoods then. You all did this. It also is firmly explained by the anarchists, the Trotskyists, and the Leninists. The propaganda of the deed is when little Willie hurls his yogurt across the kitchen and into the kitchen wall. I am important, see me. I am in pain, pay attention to me. I am making a noise, there must be something wrong. And the more the noise, the more the violence of the act, the more you recruit sympathy and attention. The propaganda of the deed. You are recognized. People write about you. People pay attention to you. Reduce the skyline of New York. Propaganda of the deed. We all know about Al-Qaeda. The strategy of provocation has two sides to it. Again, think back to your childhood. You pushed. You found out how far you could go. And when there was an overreaction, you were the victim. You established that there was sympathy coming your way. You recruited to your cause. And when there wasn't an action, a reaction, you knew just how far you could go. And the erosion of will. How many times were you bought a game or taken to the cinema because you dripped, 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 dripped? Oh, sod it. Go and play football then. Those are the generic strategies. Now, you have to adapt them, you have to use them within your circumstances and so forth. But that's how you function if you are weak and wish to win. Now, if you are strong and have nuclear weapons, you have too much to lose in using them. But whether you have them or not, you have to find a way to exert your power, to use your strength, which is more than just your military forces, your economy and so on and so forth. For as the philosopher Michel Foucault said, power is not a possession, it is a relationship. How do you establish that relationship in your powerful position? Your apparently powerful position with this apparently weak person. Finding the way to establish that relationship to advantage is the strategic question of our time. How and to what end do we apply force substrategically in the conflict so as to gain our strategic and political position in the overall confrontation? Now, this form or paradigm of war, war amongst the people, where the use of military force is sub-strategic and frequently only tactical in effect, has six characteristics or trends. Now, I call them trends because they alter in the circumstances, and you must understand them as each affecting the other. And although I shall give them to you in a list, and those of you earnest fellows who are taking down notes will write them in a list, you should actually understand them in a circle, each affecting all of the others. The first characteristic is that the ends for which we fight have changing. In industrial war, we sought to resolve the political confrontation that was its cause directly by military force. The objectives for the use of military force in industrial war are hard and simple. They tend to be expressed in terms of take, hold, destroy, defeat, unconditional surrender, and so forth. In war amongst the people, the objectives are malleable and complex. They describe a condition which enables intentions to be changed or formed by other means, political, economic, and so forth. An example would be the current one in Afghanistan, to create a safe and secure environment. Because in war amongst the people, military force does not resolve the confrontation directly, the conflicts or forceful acts contribute to one or other side's efforts to win the confrontation. And the more we seek to establish law and order, the more the will or intentions of the people, as opposed to the government or administration of those people, become the objective. Let me give you some examples of what I'm talking about, and I'll go some way back into history. My first example, and I believe the first of the wars amongst the people, was the Korean War, where we changed our intentions when China intervened, because to do otherwise was to use the atomic bomb. And we therefore settled for the condition of a divided Korea on or about the same line that the war started on. And we've had to maintain that condition of confrontation ever since, a confrontation in which that conflict nested is still unresolved and is now nuclear. The Yom Kippur War in 1973, when Sadat's objective was to create a condition by military force in which the confrontation between the Egyptians and the Israelis could be resolved. He took the Israelis completely by surprise. Not because the Israelis couldn't see what was going on, they could, but they could not conceive of someone trying to fight a war to create a negotiating position. And so they just didn't believe what they were seeing was preparations for a war. It must be an exercise. For those who want to read about it, Kissinger is probably the best, shortest read on the subject. Bosnia, Kosovo, Afghanistan, Iraq, all give examples. Regardless of the rhetoric of the time, the military are being used to establish a condition usually expressed as a safe and secure area, rather than to resolve the confrontation. An example, consider Hezbollah and Israel this year. They have been in confrontation for a long time, and their confrontation sits within the greater confrontation that has existed since the founding of the state. And drawing only on the media coverage, Hezbollah is said to have initiated the conflict, either separately or in sum, to take prisoners to bargain with, a tactical act to improve one's position in a confrontation, to draw Israel into an attack on Lebanon so as to enhance Hezbollah's position in Lebanon by showing they could defend successfully against Israel, another condition, certainly not a decisive in any conflictual sense, and or to improve their position vis-a-vis Hamas down in Gaza, and or to further Iranian objectives in their confrontations with the United States, etc., etc. In all cases, military force is being used to establish a condition to advantage. Israel, on the other hand, initially announced its ends in the hard terms of industrial war, to destroy Hezbollah and to defeat the rocket attacks. But soon, these were adjusted to the conditional objectives of gaining a viable internationally guaranteed buffer zone, re-establishing deterrence, weakening Hezbollah, and to improve their bargaining position over prisoners. And some commentary argued that Israel was also trying to coerce Lebanon into controlling Hezbollah, another conditional objective to establish by punitive means the condition in which Lebanon controls what happens within its borders. You will note one of the consequences of this is it's very difficult to define victory, or even to say what victory looks like. The next trend is that we tend to carry out these actions in multinational groupings or in non-state groupings. These coalitions, or at root collaborative confrontations, need not be the formal ones like NATO or the UN or the coalition in Iraq today. They are often, and particularly in the theatre, informal and include other non-military agencies, the OSCE, UNHCR, Oxfam or Médecins Sans Frontières. And you can have other very dangerous informal alliances where you dine with the devil for short-term tactical advantage and run grave risks of regretting it afterwards. The Northern Alliance in Afghanistan, or the Kosovo Liberation Army, the KLA, in Kosovo, being examples. I labour these trends to highlight four consequences. The difficulty of analysis and explanation, particularly when the alliance is only in theatre as opposed to at strategic level. The dangerous informal alliance with the KLA was a theatre level arrangement that all the nations of NATO were in denial about and just refusing to accept was happening, which made it extremely difficult to deal with. The problem of foreseeing the effects of a particular action in the conflict, that you, when you do something down there in the conflict, it can have unexpected consequences in the capitals of this collaborative alliance. You witness this with the British calling for reinforcements for NATO because the British got in a big fight in Afghanistan, and suddenly this other capitals weren't quite so interested in this problem. the difficulty that these groups in collaborative confrontations have in deciding on a strategy. Witness the performance of the United Nations over what to do about North Korea or what to do about the Lebanon and Israel. And if you want to another example, look at how inadequate the G8 was and the same Lebanon-Israel situation and so forth. It is extremely difficult to come to a concerted view. And finally, it is very difficult to apply the law, since the law is dependent upon the states, but you're not operating as states. And you're frequently not operating against a state. The third and most obvious trend is that war takes place amongst the people. Firstly, as I've tried to explain, the objective is the will of the people. Secondly, the opponent, often operating to the tenets of the guerrilla and the terrorist, depends upon the people for concealment, for support, both moral and physical, and for information. But these conflicts take place amongst the people in another sense, through the media. Whoever coined the phrase the theatre of war or theatre of operations was remarkably prescient. I can tell you from considerable personal experience that command of a modern operation is being like one of two or more producers in the pit of some Roman circus or amphitheatre. And down there in the sand, you have two or more lots of gladiators mixed up with the idiot who can't park his car, the people who are late for their seats, the ice cream sellers, the ticket touts, and so forth, and they're all milling around in the pit with you. And around the top, all the way around the outside you, you have this highly factional audience who are all paying attention to where it's noisiest in the pit by peering through the straws of their Coca-Cola tin. And your business is to write the most compelling narrative and act it out so that everybody understands what you want them to understand in that pit. And then you're the winner, because they think you are. And if you don't think that is the case, consider the circumstances a month and a half ago. The conflict between Hezbollah and Israel took place amongst the people in both senses that I've used the phrase. In Israel, the people and their houses, the towns and cities were manifestly the target of the rocket attacks. And Israel, in attacking Hezbollah, operating amongst the people, hit Lebanese people and property. And in the theatre, who had the most compelling narrative? On balance, and judging the majority view as it's expressed in the media, not least by The Economist with Hezbollah wins, or words to that effect across the front, Hezbollah told the best story. Who, with disciplined silence and an uncommon lack of organizational ego, played to the generic strategy that I've described, and in particular the propaganda of the deed, and they were seen to stand up to the IDF and have to be treated with. And with the strategy of provocation, particularly within the context of the greater confrontation of the whole, they were able to cast themselves as the victims. And yet, they have lost their position in southern Lebanon. There is now a barrier, an international barrier, which is yet to be tested, but it's there between them and Israel. They have lost men and materiel in large measure. They have cost their backers a great deal of loot. And they have a difficult position with the people of Lebanon, or they wouldn't be apologizing for starting the war by accident immediately afterwards. And yet, they are declared the victors. And Israel, consumed with its own difficulties in its kitchen, appears to be incapable of telling a better story. War amongst the people and the theatre of war. The fourth trend is that war amongst the people is timeless. We set out to win industrial wars quickly because the whole of the society was involved and we wanted to get back to peace and have a normal life. In our new circumstances, timing is more important than doing things to time. The basic tactic is to engage only on one's own terms and when it is to our advantage to do so safely. And when our military objectives are to set conditions in which other instruments of power are to resolve the confrontation, then of course we must maintain that condition until they succeed. And we're still in Korea, aren't we? And we're still in Cyprus. And we're still in Lebanon. Because UNIFIL, the first I in UNIFIL, stands for interim. And they deployed in 1978, if my memory serves me correctly. They've been reinforced now. So how long is interim? The fifth trend is that we fight to preserve the force. Now, no commander wants to suffer any more casualties to his men and equipment than he has to. But in industrial war, it was in the main possible to replace your losses. We developed the production lines to do this. There was conscription, the big training depots, extra reserve formations. And you had a defense industrial base. And you paid to keep the production lines open, and so forth. All of these, in this country, and in most countries, the only production line for the M1 Abrahams tank in America that is open at the moment is there to produce major spare parts. We cannot replace what we lose. I think I was the first British general since probably Wellington in the Peninsula to actually have to consider how to fight his force in 1990 in Iraq and bring it back. I had every serviceable tank in the British Army and they wanted their train set back. We fight so as to preserve the force because we have to sustain the operation. And to do that needs a continuous process. And we fight because politicians at home, uncertain of their own people's support for the venture, wish to keep the costs to men and materiel within bounds that are politically sustainable in the circumstances. And the sixth and final trend is that new uses are being found for weapons and organisations that were acquired and developed for different purposes. Now, I'm not arguing that commanders shouldn't adapt their forces to their circumstances. They jolly well should. But if we look at the use of some of our weapons, they're not being used for the purpose they were purchased for. And I, for one, in 40 years of service, have never gone to war in an organisation that I was trained in. And if that doesn't tell you that something's changing, I don't know what does. Please note that in spelling out these characteristics, I have not said that there will not be big fights or that in the future, that the future is one of urban terrorism. I'm not saying that at all. Indeed, the examples of the Yom Kippur War or some of those on the Israeli-Lebanon border or in Afghanistan this year have been big battles and were not the stuff of urban terrorism at all. Nor have I said that these fights will not be in support of the of objectives to do with the sovereignty of the state. But I am saying that force will not be used to achieve this directly or strategically. It may, if it is used well, establish a condition in which the objective is achieved by other means. Now, just before I go on to address some of the implications of this and finish this talk, I thought I'd just read you a short press cutting from the Daily Telegraph of the 2nd of October. And I was putting these notes together that day, and there in front of me, I was actually on Eurostar and had a great big pile of newspapers. There was this man, Brigadier Ed Butler, who was just coming out of Afghanistan. And this is the report in the newspaper of what he was saying as he came out. Now, gallop through it, and then as I go, I will indicate where he's hitting the characteristics I've just described. Now, I'm going to find out whether he's read my book or not, but he seems to have done so. British forces in southern Afghanistan came within hours of retreating from a key base because they suffered a critical shortage of helicopters, the task force commander, that's Ed Butler, has disclosed. In an inclusive interview with the Daily Telegraph, Brigadier Butler said Taliban fire was so heavy and accurate at Muzakala, a key forward base in northern Helmand, that army helicopters faced a serious risk of being hit. He said the loss of such crucial equipment, together with the political impact of a large loss of life, meant he came close to ordering his soldiers to abandon their base. Well, that sounds to me like fighting to preserve the force. Brigadier Butler said he had warned his superiors early last month that the intensity of Taliban attacks was such that mounting air supply and casualty evacuation missions was likely to lead to the loss of a Chinook helicopter. The brigadier who leaves his posting at the end of this week said, "The strategic significance of losing Muzakala would have been huge, but that was set against the likelihood of helicopters being lost. The political impact would have been even greater." Fighting to preserve the force, or fighting so as not to lose the force. He goes on to say, "We have made repeated pleas to NATO allies to send additional aircraft." I've touched on that one already. "We're not going to be beaten by the Taliban in Muzakala," said Brigadier Butler, "but the threat to helicopters from very professional Taliban fighters, and particularly mortar crews, was becoming unacceptable. We couldn't guarantee that we weren't going to lose helicopters. The paratroopers were within 36 hours of abandoning the base before tribal elders approached the Afghan government to negotiate a ceasefire between British forces and the Taliban in the area." Non-state actors again coming into play, a condition appearing, not a victory. "I told them, you tell the Taliban to stop firing at us and my soldiers will stop firing back at you. That seems to me more like establishing a condition than winning." Not winning in industrial terms. Said the brigadier. He called the ceasefire, which has held for 16 days, an Afghan solution. "We are bidding for people's minds here. The people are sick of war and they are turning to the government to end it. Establishing a condition, the objective is the will of the people." "I am pragmatic about this," says the brigadier. Jolly good if he is. "We won't turn Afghanistan around overnight, as some people continue to believe. Timeless. Moral, legal, ethical compasses of some people may be tested by this process, but the repercussions of failure are too great to be contemplated." I think he's saying, play it long, and the military have very little to do with this. It's all got to be done legally, economically, etc. He goes on, and there's other examples. I won't waste more time. But there is an example of war amongst the people, and it isn't just urban terrorism and so forth. Now, let me just touch some of the implications. And I've chosen ones that leaned, if you like, towards the interpretation of the law. And I'll take my last 5 minutes or so just to bring them out. The first is to understand that the people are the strategic objective. We may enter their territory, we may attack their armies, but these are ends in themselves. They are enabling objectives to gaining, at the very least, the tacit support of the people. The idea being to form their collective intention to, at the least, not support your opponent who operates amongst them, which is essentially what the good brigadier was saying about the Afghan people around that, where that particular battle was taking place. Now, there is nothing asymmetric about this. The opponent is fighting for the will of the people as well. The second implication is to do with the idea of force being an act of last resort. Now, as a generalization, the use of force was thought to be an act of last resort when considered within the paradigm of industrial war. And later, if someone wants me to, I'll explain why. But is it now? Is there an orderly process recognized by both parties in which force is the last act? If it is with North Korea, then it's nuclear. Do both parties see force as an alternative to other options instead of being used in concert with it? In other words, industrial war, peace, crisis, war, resolution, we see it as a linear process. Is it a linear process? Why does it have to be a linear process? Our opponents in war amongst the people aren't using it as a linear process at all. It's being used hand in glove with the other processes. And when all other options are exhausted, will force provide a resolution? And if it doesn't, do we just pile on more force? Or will the price be too high to bear? And what other options are there before us? If it is too high to bear, do we accept defeat? Or how do you terminate the engagement if your last resort isn't working? Is defeat an exit strategy? In any event, we have, with all other of the United Nations, not last September, a year before, a year last September, agreed that we have a responsibility to protect the citizens of the world from the abuse of their civil rights. The unconditional surrender of Germany in 1945 was brought about by using force as an act of last resort. Otherwise, we wouldn't have heard about appeasement. But it didn't stop the Holocaust. When do we use military force, and in what combination of measures to discharge our responsibility to protect that we all signed up to a year ago last September? And is the answer to these questions the same at all levels, from political through strategic through theatre to the tactical? I suggest it was in industrial war, and our institutional thinking is still predicated on that experience. But I don't think that's the correct answer anymore. As a result of, and in particular, the first three of my trends, we are confused about accountability and responsibilities. Who gives strategic direction or makes the theatre operational plan in Afghanistan or Iraq? And how have we got our coroners deciding on whether it was a good plan or not, and whether the tactics were right on some road in Iraq. Who's responsible and where? For what? We're confused about rules of engagement and law. We seem to think those two things are synonyms or synonymous, and they're not. We're confused about proportionality. What and what are not legitimate targets? And we're certainly confused about the status of the individual caught up in war amongst the people. The whole sorry saga of Guantanamo Bay being but an example. We tend to think of neutrality and impartiality as being synonyms, and they are not. If UNIFIL fails, then I lay you a small wager that it will fail because it is confused between the difference between neutrality and impartiality, just as we were in the United Nations in Bosnia for a very long time. And we fail to understand the centrality of the law to our successful outcome of the confrontation. And I will dwell just a minute on this. Any examination of the desired outcome of the wars amongst the people leads you to the recognition that there is the desired outcome contains some form of law and order, whether it be treaty law or day-to-day order and law upon the streets of a city. And yet we are extremely bad because of our linear thinking as institutions and our structures of institutions in recognizing that in the first instance. And so frequently we shatter the capacity to establish the law before we start to build a capacity and are surprised that it takes a very long time thereafter. And one of the biggest things we have, our problem, and this touches across the whole of the institutions, is to understand what I call the currency of deterrence. And I'll stray a little over my 40 minutes by expanding on this. The soldier, me, I achieve my purpose because the currency of deterrence that I represent is the live rounds in my rifle. And if you don't do what I tell you, I will kill you. And if you believe I will kill you, 99.9 times out of 10, you will do what I tell you. The currency of deterrence is the ball in my magazine and the confidence in your mind that I will do what I've said I can do and I can find you and shoot you. So I'm collecting information to target you. I am imparting information to tell you that I can see you and I will do what I say I will do. That's the role of information. But the actual currency of the deterrent is the ball in the magazine and my ability to shoot it at you. But that is not the currency of the deterrence of the law. The currency of the deterrence of the law is evidential information capable of sustaining a successful prosecution. And that is a very different thing to the information that I, the soldier, want in order to shoot you. Now, until the militaries have the capacity, and they have the capacity, are allowed to and are encouraged and it is developed, to develop the capacity to collect this other currency of deterrence, evidential information, and start to pass it to those who can use it to prosecute, you will not remove the military from the street because you haven't changed the currency of deterrence. And unfortunately, it is extremely difficult to sustain the value of my currency of deterrence because, just like children back in the playground, the strategies of provocation quickly find out where the boundaries are. And so it should be no surprise to you, on the analysis I've just given you, that organized crime grows in areas where conflict has been taking place. Because almost all capacity to gather the deterrent, the information that supports the deterrence of the law, has been destroyed and ruptured, and the military are unsuited to collect it. And we do not understand what I have just said in institutional and organizational terms. So what must we do? To be brief, we must change the way we think from the linear structure of thinking of industrial war that our institutions have grown up in, and to recognize that we must now be conducting war amongst the people, which means that we have got to be able to do this trick of translating our currencies, and we must change our organizations, our institutional structures, and thinking in particular, so that you are able to do all of these things at the same time to one purpose and in one direction. And I've gone over my 40 minutes, for which I apologize.
I think that reaction shows in itself that no apology is needed for having gone over the time. Sir Rupert, we're happy to answer some questions. Could I please ask you to observe the following sort of basic principles? First of all, use the microphone. The acoustics in this room are not designed to enable us to hear somebody at the back of the auditorium if you don't. There are stewards wandering around with handheld microphones. If you want to ask a question, please take one of those. Secondly, would you please begin your question by saying who you are, so that I have some idea, and so does Sir Rupert, of where the question is coming from. Now, it doesn't mean to say you have to give a complete CV, the way that some people seem to want to do, but could I ask you just to give your name, please? Do that even if you consider you are so famous that everybody knows you anyway. First of all, the people sitting behind you may not recognise you from your back. Secondly, I haven't got my glasses on, so I may not recognise you from the front either. And thirdly, this is a good way of avoiding the horrible realisation that you're not as famous as you think you are. And lastly, if you could please ask a question, and one question per person only, not make a speech. With that in mind, who would like to go first? In the gallery at the front, the lady sitting down there. No, other side of the gallery. Yes, that's done. Thank you. And I'll gather up three or four questions first.
My name is Hiba Nigm, and I'm a PhD student in International Relations Department. And my question to you, sir, is where would you cite technology in your art of modern war? Thank you. Where would you put technology?
Technology.
Role. Do you see any kind of role for technology in transforming the art of war in the modern warfare? Thank you.
Thank you. And then the second one, the gentleman in the blue jumper, about three rows in here on the in the ground floor.
Mike Jenkins Kings. Given that you've used the analogy of the kids in the nursery, you've also assumed that the parents looking after them have both experience or wisdom in order to make sure they go the right way. Could you give your views about whether all the kids in the nursery have actually that wisdom, and whether intervention and our current expeditionary policies are valid for future and the art of modern war.
Thank you. And then the last question, the third question in this batch, the gentleman up there in the gallery. Yes, thank you.
You've spoken about the need for progression in institutions which aren't fit for purpose. Is the answer, rather than progression, actually to regress to a stage where their moderating effect on the total escalation and use of force isn't at such a point, and there needs to be a realisation of our ineptitude in trying to fight limited war?
Thank you. Sorry, and you are?
War Studies, King's College London. Lee Kirkshott.
Can I have it again, too? I don't understand.
I'm sorry? Yeah, no, of course. Is the answer not to reform institutions and agencies, but rather to regress to a stage where there is an acceptance that limited war is not something that can be won, and that the moderating effect of these institutions on the use of force should be taken away?
Right, thank you. Well, that presents three fairly challenging questions. Let's hear the answers to those first before we take any more.
Yes, it's challenging because they're all so different. I'll take them in the order they came in. Of course, technology has a part in warfare, regardless of its type. I'd go back to my metaphor of the realists and the impressionists. In the art of war, it is not so much the paintbrushes or the canvas and so forth that makes the difference. It's the way they're used to achieve the outcome intended. The science of war is where you start to enter the technological field. Can I have a better paintbrush, a more vivid red, or whatever? This is the remarkable thing is that in war amongst the people, increasingly it is not the obvious things that are being used as the weapons, or they were judged to be obsolescent in industrial war terms. So the suicide bomber must be understood as a weapon, a cruise missile, which is arguably more effective than the extremely expensive cruise missiles we have in our inventories. And in a minute. If you consider it as a weapon, the technology and so forth, that's the impact these things are having. You can have the technologies of the internet and so on and so forth are all being used in modern warfare by both sides and so forth, and has a direct impact. But they tend to be those that are of amongst the people. I find it extremely interesting to see where that may take us when you consider things like defense industries and so forth. The danger of using a metaphor of the playroom is played out in the questioner. I have no intention of trying to discuss the parents in trying to just give you an example from your memories of one's childhood or bringing up children of the strategies of provocation and so on and so forth. But behind it, there was a question, I think, that of the expeditionary's nature of our operations. And I think implied, so what do you do about strategies and provocation and so on and so forth? In a nutshell, the counter-strategy, generic strategy, lies on two tracks. One is to operate to learn instead of making assumptions, because you've got to learn who your opponent is and how he's functioning so as to isolate him from the people. Otherwise, you involve the people and they tend to side with the opponent as a result. And the second is to concentrate on altering the context. Go back to the example of the playroom. The revolting child's strategy of provocation or propaganda of the deed, if it is in the incorrect context, fails for the child. And so your business as the strategist on the other side
is to try and change the context of the way things are seen and acted out, rather than to deal in the first instance with the actual issue that's presented to you by the child, as it were. Yeah, I hope that's enough of an answer there. And then the last one was institutions. Should we stop worrying about the institutions and making them change and head off with some new ones? No? It's partly my hearing, which is bad, and it's nothing to do with the acoustics.
But no, that wasn't the question. The question was obviously the problem with institutions is you're talking about confusion and responsibility, and that institutions, they stop people escalating force properly because they provide a moderating influence. And the reason we lose is because we don't use enough. Our escalation of war and our total use of force is not there. The logic of force is ignored. Is it not important to have a realization and then to stop the fact that popular sovereignty is a restraining use and actually have total use of force to win wars and not be fighting these limited wars where our resolve is weakened?
Institutions and escalation are two different things, and it is not necessarily so that your institution inhibits your ability to escalate. And if it is, it isn't necessarily wrong that is happening. But behind it, as I think I've now heard you say, is that you shouldn't endeavour to limit your use of force at all. In which case, go back to my almost fourth paragraph about the strategies of provocation and propaganda of the deed. Go and imagine a set of circumstances where that is played against you, and see whether you will triumph with unlimited use of force. You may, in a purely tactical or Stalinesque way, and you will leave a wasteland like Grozny or somewhere like that, and not much else, but you will certainly not have resolved your confrontation. You may well have think you've rubbed out your opponent, but this is timeless, and they come back.
Right, now I think I've got time to take two further questions. The lady in the green scarf down here, and then the gentleman in the white shirt in the front row of the gallery.
Hi, Janann Brownell with Newsweek magazine and an LSE alum. I wanted to ask you, I'm reading Norman Dixon's On the Psychology of Military Incompetence right now, and I realize that it's the 30th anniversary of the publication of that book, and I wanted to ask you, if you were to update that book now, what military incompetencies would you include in that? And also, do you think that book still holds relevance to the British Army in general to this day? Have we learned anything from that since the publication of that book in reference to the Army?
And the gentleman in the gallery?
John Hemmings, I'm an MA student from King's. My question is, what wars since World War II would you classify, if any, as the old model, the Industrial War, or whether all wars since 1945 have actually been of this new model of limited means?
Can we roll up a third question?
Yep, I'll meet.
The lady in the back, at the back of the ground floor in the purple jumper. As well as not having my glasses on, I've got no sense of colour, so if I'm insulting you in the colours that I'm singling out, I hope you'll forgive me.
You've got the blind on one hand and the deaf here. Thank God we're not dumb.
You've probably got the unintelligent here. Lynn Verity, the concept of war amongst the people, do you ultimately see the decline of the nation state?
Right. Wow. Again, in order. It's a smashing book. I do recommend The Psychology of Military Incompetence to anyone who hasn't read it. I recognise myself on all sorts of pages. And it's mostly about the British Army, so it's certainly relevant to the British Army, and it explains a great deal about how big organisations work. It needn't be read as just the military. And yes, I think it's the essential message of it is relevant today. I'd have to go back and read it with rather more care, and certainly not in this audience and in public would I declare who I would stick in it. But I can think of one or two. I have two wars which I... the first is the first Iraq war, the Iranian-Iraq war, essentially across the Shatt al-Arab in the 80s, which was... I have difficulty in fitting... In fact, I can't fit into War Amongst the People. Except that it... And I say I can't because it doesn't hit the majority of my characteristics. But it certainly was not... it was timeless. All it did was to achieve a condition and so on and so forth. It hit some of them. It doesn't hit them all or the majority. The other one that I would argue is borderline is the Falklands War of 82, where we are certainly fighting a campaign to achieve a strategy, and it looks very industrial and old-fashioned in its structures and so forth, and yet it hits most of those characteristics, although not very hard. The condition, we return to the condition of the confrontation antebellum. What the Argentinians certainly started and invaded and so forth in order to do the Sadat trick of altering the terms of the negotiation. What they were surprised by was the British, or in particular Mrs. Thatcher's actions, who promptly went to war over it when they hadn't anticipated that. So that, as I say, is a bit borderline, but we're back with a condition. This was state on state, so that characteristic doesn't fit. It wasn't amongst the people in the physical sense, but it was quite close to being amongst the people in the visual sense, although that wasn't quite realised then because the technology didn't allow it and the geography didn't allow it and so on. It's timeless in that we still have a garrison there, we still haven't resolved this matter. We didn't worry too much about casualties. We didn't want to have anyone killed, but my regiment had 257, I think it was, notifiable casualties, of which 44 were dead. We lost 7 ships. We'd be leaping up and down if that was what was happened today in Afghanistan or Iraq. If we had casualties at that sort of level. So it doesn't quite fit. And then the last one is, do I see the end of the nation state? No. I think what's happening is our interpretation, our demands of the state is changing. We need the state to administer us. We need the state to hold things in common. Like the National Health Service or whatever it is to handle that sort of things, those aren't going to go away. But it's harder and harder for the state to act as a state. The interdependence of states is now becoming something that is limiting sovereignty. And even a state as powerful and as large as the United States cannot act on its own. In the Middle East, it tried to, and can't. And it's a long book, but I commend it to you by Philip Bobbitt, called *The Shield of Achilles*, where he discusses this. And I find much of what he has to say directly relevant to my own experience, particularly of the last 20 years of my service, mostly operating in multinational organizations.
Right, well, I think we'd better stop it at that point. Let me, before I turn to thank Rupert, to just make a couple of announcements. The first is that what you've seen this evening is, of course, a vivid illustration of precisely what the International Humanitarian Law Project is about. If any of you would like to receive further information about that, we'd be very happy to put you on our mailing list. Just go to the IHL page on the LSE's website. That will give you details of our forthcoming events. Those of you from the War Studies Department at King's who were exceptionally active in asking questions will be expected to wear a rosette or some other fixed distinguishable sign at the next lecture. The next lecture is by John Bellinger, who is the legal advisor to the US State Department, and he is going to talk about Guantanamo Bay and its future, if any, on the 31st of October. That is a ticket-only event, simply because of the level of interest that has been expressed in it. So if you would like a ticket for that, please do contact us. The next announcement is that there are drinks after this lecture on the fifth floor in the senior dining room. Not the senior common room, please, but the dining room itself. And I very much hope that as many of you as possible will join us for that. And then a few words of thanks. First of all, to the Law Society Charity for funding this event. And we're very grateful indeed for the support that they've given to the IHL project generally. Secondly, to three people associated with the project who did the lion's share, in fact, all of the work in organising this event. Heather Harrison-Dinnis, who was responsible for setting it all up and for inviting our speaker. Louise Arimatsu, who's done sterling work in running the project generally. And Jasmine Musa, who helped out with many of the last-minute preparations for this event. It's an indication of how much you have done and how successfully that what you have done has largely gone unnoticed at this event. It's been a seamless web of organisation. But lastly, and most importantly, our grateful thanks to General Sir Rupert Smith for a most interesting and provocative lecture, and also for some fascinating answers to questions that ranged from who's the most incompetent soldier of modern times through the future of the nation state to whether there is any purpose in moderation in modern warfare. Many of the questions posed to Sir Rupert reminded me of an examiner's meeting I went to in my young and enthusiastic days when I'd set an exceptionally awkward question. And a senior lawyer colleague said, "That's the kind of question I wouldn't dream of answering for less than 5,000 guineas." Many of the questions posed to you, Sir Rupert, and some of the questions you posed to the audience definitely fell into the 5,000 guinea category, and I haven't yet made allowance for inflation. But it was, if I thought, a fascinating example of how in modern military life you have to think across such a wide range of issues, and how those of us in civilian life who look both at the control of armed forces and the purposes for which force might be used have to rethink many of the assumptions which we've carried forward from a bygone age. It's always said that generals spend their lives fighting the last war, pacifists opposing the last war, and lawyers legislating for the last war. We have certainly seen an example of a general who isn't spending his life going on about the last war, but is very much focused on the next. Thank you very much indeed.